One honk. Two honks. Three honks. Four. Five honks. Six honks. Seven. Eight. Nine. 10. 11. 12. 13. 14. Yes, 15. 16. 17. 18. 19. 20 beautiful honks! Oh, wonderful! What?
Vayidaber Adonai El Moshe Lemor Nasa Esrosh B'nei Gerishon Gam Haim Levei Savosam Lemishbechosam. Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, take a census of the sons of Gerishon as well, according to their father's household, according to their families. OU Israel presents
Come In. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Naso, both here in Israel and outside of Israel. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 10th day of Sivan, 5775, corresponding to May 28th. What you heard in the very beginning was a small clip from a Sesame Street piece about Count Von Count counting honks. There are these little animals called honkers, and they beep their nose and they make a different sound, and he had them do it one at a time so he could count them. And that fits, of course, with the opening words and the name of the Sedra of Naso. Count the children of Gershon, the family of Gershon, in addition to the family of Kahat that you have already counted. This is the second counting of Leviim. The first in Parshat Bamidbar was to get a population count of Levi, and therefore boys were counted from 1 month of age and up. But in the census of the workforce of Leviim, they were counted from the age of 30 to the age of 50. Just a side point, when the count was counting, he did not count honkers, he counted honks. And that's an indirect method of counting, and reminiscent of the counting of the silver half shekel per person, rather than counting the people themselves. There happens to be a dispute among commentaries as to whether when God commands Moshe to count the people, either the whole population of Israel or the Leviim, whether he can do that by direct count, because if God commands it, then he's not doing anything wrong by counting them. When it's a census that was taken for whatever purpose that the Jewish people had, not at God's command, then they were duty-bound to use the silver half shekel as an indirect method of counting, lest a stigma, a limit, an ayin hara, or something bad happens when you give a number to a large group of people. The custom in Israel is not to say Tachanun from Rosh Chodesh Sivan through the 12th. The reason, which is this Shabbat, the reason for that particular number is that whereas Pesach is 7 days, and Shavuot and Sukkot is 7 days plus Shmini Atzeret. Shavuot is but a single day, and when people came to Yerushalayim, Aliyah LeRegel, for Shavuot, and they brought with them animals to offer in the Beit HaMikdash as sacrifices, either obligatory ones or voluntary optional ones, they needed more time, and they used the days after Shavuot for that purpose, and they became semi-festive. And we note that by not saying Tachanun during this period. The days are known as Yemei Miluim. They are 6 days after the 1 day of Shavuot to fill in the holiday's length to be the same as Pesach and Sukkot. Therefore, we will say Tehillim Kuf Kaf Aleph Psalm 121. Shir Lama Alot Esa Einai El Heharim Me'ayin Yavo Ezri. Ezri Me'im Adonai Osei Shamayim Va'aretz. Al Yitain Lamot Raglecha Al Yanum Shomerecha. Hine Lo Yanum V'lo Yishan Shomer Yisrael. Adonai Shomerecha Adonai Tzilecha Al Yad Yeminecha. Yomam Hashemesh Lo Yakeka V'yoreach Balayla. Adonai Yishmorcha Mikol Ra Yishmoret Nafshecha. Adonai Yishmor Tzeidcha Uvoecha Me'ata V'ad Olam. Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael Hanatunim Batzara Uvashivya Ha'omedim Bein Bayam Uvein Bayabasha Hamakom Yerachem Aleihem V'yotzieim Mitzara Lirvacha U'me'afela La'ora U'mishibud L'gu'ula Hashta Ba'agala U'vizman Kariv V'nomar Amen. Okay, before we get into Parshat Naso per se, actually let me say a couple of words about Naso. Naso is usually, not always, but usually the Sedra following Shavuot. When it isn't immediately after Shavuot, it's immediately before Shavuot, which means Naso is the Shavuot Parsha. Naso is the longest Parsha in the whole Torah. 54 weekly sedras. Naso is by far the biggest in number of psukim, 176, in number of words, in number of letters, in number of lines it takes up in a Torah, number of columns it takes up in a Torah, any way you slice it, which sometimes varies from one base to another, not in Naso's case. It is the largest parsha. And Sefer HaTodah, I think, Eliyahu Kitov, mentions that that's significant only in sheer number size, because when we annually celebrate the receiving of the Torah, the parsha that's right around there is the largest bite of Torah that there is. It shows a certain enthusiasm. In any event, the other noteworthy thing is, besides it being the largest Sedra, it has, as I mentioned, 176 psukim. And that's significant because 176 is 22 times 8. That's significant because 22 is the number of letters in the Hebrew alphabet, and 8 is a number that is associated by one step beyond natural, as in the eighth day of Brit Milah, which is the eighth mitzvah in the Torah, not in the Taryag list, but after the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, and other eight, Shmini Atzeret, and other significance to the number 8. It's a 22 is a complete number, like 100 would be, but 22 because of the letters of the alphabet, and 8 is also a significant group. In fact, the longest perek in Tanakh is chapter 119 of Tehillim, Psalms, which has 176 psukim broken down to 8 psukim beginning with an aleph, and 8 with a bet, and 8 with a gimel, all the way through 8 with a tuf. Furthermore, the largest of the tractates of Talmud, of Gemara. In the Babylonian Talmud, Talmud Bavli, is Masechet Bava Batra, which has 176 double pages. Gemaras are counted in folio, meaning two sides of a sheet have the same page number, and Kuf Ayin Vav, 176, is the longest Gemara. And that matches the longest Sedra, and makes that statement again of devotion to Torah after having received it, full, big number. So that's Parshat Naso from the outside. We'll look at it on the inside in a little while. But I want to give another take, audio style, on the lead tidbit this week. Very, very often it happens to me that I get an idea for a lead tidbit. I work on it, I write it, I change the title, or I keep the working title that we start with, and I have however much room on the front page, and then page 4, and that's it. And very rarely, except when I'm really, really pressed for space and I really need to say more, I don't go beyond that. So there is a hagbalah, a limiting factor in the written Torah tidbits. When it comes to a couple of days later, namely Torah Tidbits audio, as you are listening to right now, I sometimes am able to say more and better or polished, or even unpolished, but to get points across in an oral sense. So I want to rework that idea. The lead tidbit was entitled The Expanded Dayenu Checklist. I'll explain that maybe, otherwise you could read it yourself. It's available online at www.ttidbits.com, and you will find the link to several different versions of the file. Easy to download, hard to download, full format, text only, whatever, light version, extra light version. So let's leave that for a moment and put it this way. When we commemorate something in the calendar, it is not just to remember or to be reminded of. It comes along with a call to review the reality of that which we are commemorating. I'll tell you what I mean. Shavuot, Zman Matan Toratenu, the time of the giving of the Torah, the time of the receiving of the Torah, the time B'nai Yisrael entered into a covenant with God, where he said to us, V'atem tehiyu li mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh, you will be a kingdom of kohanim and a holy nation unto me. And we said to him, all that God says we will do. We will do, we will do, and understand. And that covenant is basically what we commemorate on Shavuot each year. But wait a minute, you can't just put away the Shavuot machzor and put away your cheesecake recipes for another year. You need, we need, each to reflect on, is it really so? In other words, did we and do we continue to receive the Torah? Let me make another connection there for a moment. Bachodesh HaShelishi, Letzeit B'nai Yisrael Me'eretz Mitzrayim, in the third month of the Exodus, Bayom Hazeh, on this day we arrived at Sinai. This day, says Rashi, means Rosh Chodesh Sivan, and this day, which is not the way you tell a story. You tell a story by saying, once upon a time, a long time ago, on that day. When you say on this day, says Rashi in other commentaries, that receiving the Torah yihyu be'einecha kechadashim. It should be like a new experience. And therefore, it's not enough to say, oh yes, we received the Torah 3,327 years ago. You need to ask the question of yourself and of the Jewish people, did we truly receive the Torah again now? That means, do we learn Torah? Do we keep the mitzvot? Are we meticulous about the performance of mitzvot? Are we diligent about the learning of Torah? And if the answer is, well, sometimes, maybe, a little bit, or no, not really, then that's what Shavuot has to catch you before you put away those proverbial cheesecake recipes. So it comes along with not just a commemoration, but it comes along with a reliving, like was done with the Seder. Behold, Dor Vador Chayev Adam Lirot Tatzmo Kilu Hu Yatza Mimitzrayim. In every generation, a person has to see as if he came out of Egypt. In every generation, a person has to see himself as if he stood at Sinai and received the Torah. And therefore, the question is not a 3,300 plus years ago question. It's a now question. Do you accept the Torah? Do you enter into the covenant with God as I stated before? And there's more. If you do, or you're satisfied with your own answer, then the question asks, what about others? Do you participate in any kind of framework where you give shiurim, write divrei Torah, tutor somebody, teach others to accept the Torah like you do? Do you strive for greater Torah acceptance on your part and receiving? Do you strive in a pleasant way, Durachecha Darchei Noam, to spread Torah to others so that at the annual Torah checkup, which comes at this time, you should be able to say yes? And there's more. Shavuot is Yom HaBikurim, meaning it's the beginning of the Bikurim season. Bikurim is a mitzvah of Eretz Yisrael. Bikurim is a mitzvah of the Beit HaMikdash. Bikurim is a mitzvah that is accompanied by a declaration thanking God for taking us out of Egypt and for bringing us to the land of Israel. Reality check. Are you, first of all, reality check, we can't bring Bikurim today because we don't have a Beit HaMikdash. Do you feel the loss and the lack of a Beit HaMikdash? And what are you doing about it? Because we have the ability, in many respects, to hasten that time when the Beit HaMikdash will be restored and we will bring Bikurim again. So it's not enough just to go through, okay, dairy dishes, let's have a dairy meal at night and a meat dish, a meat lunch, or vice versa, or have this for breakfast, or make a dessert, or make a main dish, or whatever. That's not enough for Shavuot. Shavuot means a reassessment of a person's commitment to Torah, commitment to Eretz Yisrael, commitment to the Geula Shlema. This is what I meant with an expanded Dayenu checklist, because Dayenu brings us out of Egypt into across the Red Sea, into the Midbar with the Mun, with the Shabbat, with the Sinai experience, into Eretz Yisrael, and to the Beit HaMikdash. And therefore, when you go through that list, now that list in the Dayenu song was our singing thank you to God for all of the above. Now, it's true that at certain periods in Jewish history, You can put a check mark next to each one of the 15 items in the Dayenu, and they will all be true. It is equally so that there are periods in Jewish history where you can't really put a full check mark next to Uvana Lanu at Beit HaMikdash, because right now Beit HaMikdash is in ruins. So the expanded checklist is, these are the things we thank God for, and these are the items which we still have on our agenda, either to acknowledge or to accomplish or to pray for or any combination thereof. That's the idea. To put it in a very different way, just in the form of an analogy, picture a gift that you got, a very significant gift that you got from someone. It could be a bar mitzvah gift, a wedding gift, whatever. Let's take the wedding gift as an example, and let's take a silver challah knife. A silver challah knife that you use every Shabbat gives you cause to at least think an additional thank you to the person who gave you that gift in the first place. You like the knife, you've had it sharpened many times, you have a nice velvet zippered bag for it, and it brings a smile to your face every time you use it, which is every Shabbat. And then you call that person, or you run into him during the week or whatever, and you say, you know, I was thinking about your last Shabbat. I think about you often because you're the one who gave us that silver challah knife, and I really, really love it. Now, picture something else. Picture the challah knife that was the same gift, but that it broke or got lost or left someplace 2-3 years after you got married, and now down the road, once in a while, you remember the challah knife because you're using a substitute for it with an olive wood handle, and you really like that one, but you're not doing it, you're not using it, you lost it. It's a very, very different quality thank you. And that we have to think of in terms of what we have, Torah, Eretz Yisrael, Beit HaMikdash, etc., etc. Very different from when you have these things, or for when you lost these things, or never really had them in the first place. Hold that thought. We'll continue with more Torah Tidbits audio in a moment. You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Naso. I'd like to play one of my favorite tracks, and from an album by Baruch Levine. The words come from the prayer that a woman says after she lights candles on Friday night and Yom Tov, and it belongs on this show because this is a pre-Shabbat show. It belongs because this expresses a very, very deep-rooted prayer of all the Jewish people. The words translate into, "And to make me worthy of raising wise and understanding children and grandchildren who love God and are in awe of Him, people of truth, sacred offspring who would adhere to God and illuminate the world with Torah and worthy activities, and with all the means of worshiping the Creator."
Zakeini ligadel Bonim uvneivonim Chachomim unevoinim Oy avei Hashem Yirei Elokim Anshei emes Zera koidesh Bahashem dveikim
The rabbinic mitzvah of lighting candles is fulfilled when you strike a match and light Shabbos candles and make the bracha on them. But the real meaning of Shabbos candles is expressed in this beautiful tefillah prayer that a woman says after she lights the candles, and it puts such rich meaning into this particular act of Jewish life. Vizakeni, Baruch Levin. Okay, a running summary of Parshat Naso. Naso begins in the middle of the counting of the Levi families. Kahat was counted at the end of Parshat Bamidbar. I've always suspected that Naso should have started a little bit earlier with that Naso, and somehow it got mixed up, but I don't know if there's any truth to that. Here, after having counted and defined the tasks of the Kahat family, the Torah begins Parshat Naso with counting of Gershon and its tasks, followed by Merari and its tasks. And the numbers and who's in charge, etc., etc. After that, we have a relatively short piece about the requirement to isolate or quarantine, maybe is a better word, certain levels of ritual impurity, person who contracted them, from excluding him from different parts of the camp. A mitzora is quarantined outside the entire camp, and we won't get involved in that. The zav and the zava, not allowed to be in Machane Levia, but is permitted in Machane Yisrael. A temei mate, which we'll spend a few minutes talking about, a person ritually defiled from coming into contact with a dead body. This includes even being under the same roof with the body, even if there was no contact, and that means people who attend a funeral where the body is brought into the chapel become, again, Temei Mate. A Temei Mate is allowed in the camp of Israel, is allowed in the Levite camp, and is excluded from the divine camp. The divine camp is defined as the Beit HaMikdash in the olden time. In the first case it was the Mishkan, but then became the Beit HaMikdash later, and its courtyards. Today, without a Beit HaMikdash, most people hold that the sanctity of the place where the temple stood and will again stand still exists, and therefore the general guideline is that a person who's Temei Mate, meaning everybody, does not go onto the Temple Mount, specifically on those places which might, important word, might have been where the Mikdash stood or its courtyards. And since there is not complete agreement by scholars as to exact measurement of an Amma and the exact location of the different parts of the Beit HaMikdash, there is a larger area on the Temple Mount which is bedrock and could have been the place where the Mikdash stood, and that's off limits halachically from anyone visiting. The only people who are allowed there would be security personnel on the job. So this translated itself somehow in some circles to, you're not allowed to go into the Temple Mount today. That's not really honestly so. There are portions of the Temple Mount which are not on bedrock and definitely not where the Beit HaMikdash stood. They are either additional parts of the Temple Mount that were added in the time of Herod, or even original Temple Mount, but definitely not where the Mikdash stood, which have the halakhic status at most of Machane Levia, which means a Temei Mate, a person ritually defiled from contact to a dead body, is allowed there. But the Tum'ah HaYotzei Min HaGuf, the ritual impurity that comes from discharges of the body, would rule you out of Machane Levia. The thing is that we can rid ourselves of that level of tumah by immersion in a mikveh, and we can't get rid of tumat meit, ritual impurity, from contact with a corpse until we have the potion produced from the ashes of the para aduma, the red heifer, and therefore that's not an option today. But there are people who accept the approach that if you are properly guided as to where you can and cannot ascend the Temple Mount, then you may, after going to the mikveh, not wearing leather shoes and a few other restrictions. And there are some people who feel that this is an obligation, a duty for us to do this, because it perpetuates a Jewish presence on the Temple Mount, especially in times when we have Arab factions who are trying to delegitimize the Jewish origins of and connection and history to the Temple Mount, and claim that Jews had nothing to do with it. So if they point to the fact that Jews in general, or religious Jews in particular, do not even visit the Holy Temple Mount, then, you know, what does that say about their right to claim that it's theirs? So this becomes not a halachic thing, but a political thing, or however you want to describe it. And I would say that anybody who would like to visit the Temple Mount, I will tell you from personal experience, it is a extremely spiritual experience, and fraught with both a joy and a sadness and a melancholy all mixed together, because of what was there and what will be there and what's not there. I can never forget seeing Arab kids playing soccer and running and kicking a ball right in the area that was the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash, where the Mizbeach, the atoning Mizbeach, stood. And it was right out of the picture of Shualim Hilchuvo, foxes running around the ruins of Beit HaMikdash. But it's an important thing to consider. I would not recommend going without consultation with your Rav, but I would recommend doing it in consultation, and of course knowing where to go and where not to go, and what to say and what to do. The reality is that the Arabs pay older women to sit on Har HaBayit just to heckle and scream and curse out Jewish women who go up onto Har HaBayit, and there are similar situations for men as well. It's not something we should back away from, but enough said on that. The next parsha, the next portion in Parshat Naso, is about the requirement of saying vidui, verbal confession, in the process of repenting and atoning, or hoping to achieve atonement, for various and sundry sins. It also mentions specifically the requirement, which sort of seems obvious, of making restitution if we're talking about a monetary sin against a fellow. This is followed by two separate topics that are lumped together into a long aliyah, that of Sota, a wife suspected of infidelity by her husband, and warned in front of witnesses not to be seen in the presence of a certain man in a compromising situation. And then the requirement, if she violates that, of bringing her to the Beit HaMikdash, and the process of Sota is undertaken. I don't know if now is the time, or if I have enough time to devote to this topic, but it is a very serious issue with a lot of detail. We're not talking about an unfaithful wife. We're talking about a wife that is suspected of infidelity, and the suspicion is eating away at the marital harmony, and the process of the visit to the Beit HaMikdash and the potion that is administered under certain circumstances is meant not only to dispel the suspicion, but in the case where it is unfounded, to increase the feeling of harmony and reconciliation. This is followed by the topic of Nazir, the Nazirite, who takes a vow, usually for a month, to become a Nazir, which involves not drinking wine or eating any product of the grape, not cutting hair, and not becoming ritually defiled to a dead body, even one of the close relatives that a regular Kohen is allowed to defile himself to. It's on the level of the Kohen Gadol, and the only dead body that a Nazir would be required to deal with would be one found by him in the woods or something like that, with no one else to take care of it. And the whole topic is how do we in Judaism view, how are we taught by the Torah to view someone who takes on additional personal restrictions which are not for everybody? In other words, we're all allowed to drink wine. We have to drink reasonably, sensibly, ritually, not in excess. And here's a person who takes a vow which includes his not drinking wine at all. So on the one hand, he's restricting himself more than is required by Jewish law, and he has now a problem of what to say for Kiddush and the four cups of wine at the Seder and Havdalah, and that's a technical kind of problem. On the other hand, it seems that there are people who need this limited period, that 1 month of extreme restrictions, to sort of bring them back to an even keel. Someone who had certain kind of excesses might need the extra incentive, we'll say, of the Nazirite vow. This is followed by Birchat Kohanim. The Kohanim are commanded to bless the people every day, as is done in Israel, and as is not done in Chutz La'aretz, with the exception of Yom Tov. Some communities do have more frequent Birchat Kohanim. But the Kohanim are to bless the people, and the Psukim indicate that it is not as the giver of the blessing, but as the conduit of transferring the blessing from God via Birkat Kohanim to the people. In Israel, it's not only done every day, but it's done twice on Shabbat and on Yom Kippur, even in many communities, three times, including Ne'ilah, in addition to Shacharit and Musaf. That's Birchat Kohanim. Side point is that fathers and mothers and grandfathers and grandmothers have borrowed Birchat Kohanim, apparently with permission, even if they're not Kohanim, to bless their children and grandchildren on Friday night. And it is a very special thing to have done. I had an opportunity a number of years ago to spend Friday night dinner with a group of Protestant ministers from Canada at the Dan Panorama Hotel. I was to be their guest speaker for the evening, and instead of letting them eat their own dinner and then getting together in a ballroom for a lecture, a shiur, I suggested, and they took the idea, of turning the meal into a demonstration or a lesson in practical Judaism. I had with me one of my daughters and her family, and explaining everything, Shalom Aleichem and Eshet Chayil and Kiddush, etc., etc. It included also the blessing of children, and I explained it and I showed it, and a few people came up to me afterwards and said, you know, a lot of the things you talk about, we have also. Sacramental wine and this and that and the other thing. But the one thing that struck me that we don't have is a father blessing his children and his grandchildren. And that was very impressive to them. That's Birchat Kohanim as well. Not all of Nusso, but all the time we have for this week's Torah Tibbetz audio. Shabbat Shalom and Lahish Tameah.